Thank you, Mark. So yes, as Mark said, what I want to tell you about today are two problems which I've been working on. One sort of represented over here, which Mark mentioned, in which we wanted to study solutions to Maxwell's equations in free space. And in particular, we wanted to look at the field lines. And we wanted to look at knotted structures in the field lines of the electric field and the magnetic field in free space. And in particular, we're going to look at a couple of special cases, solutions where these field lines have a very intricate structure that behaves very well. And I'm going to try and sort of take them apart and use them to try and establish what the rules are for knotted structures in Maxwell fields in free space. And the second part, which by contrast is actually going to involve experiments, I want to tell you about some experiments we've been doing in my lab in Chicago, in which we created and studied the evolution of vortex loops. Okay. Now, vortex loops, where many of us are familiar with as smoke rings. Okay, now, of course, with an audience like this, a ring would be too simple. And I'm going to tell you about experiments in which we created vortex loops which are tied into knots, and vortex loops which are linked to each other. And the general theme, of course, is the theme of our workshop. It's knots in physical fields. And yesterday, we sort of started a discussion about what the general areas and the general questions which we're all facing are. So I'm going to make an effort in the two pieces of work to point out kind of a perspective on what I think are the general problems that we all face, to sort of tie it into that discussion. And it's sort of hard to talk about, actually, in fact, both of these topics without going back to the beginning, to Lord Kelvin, who sort of got all this going. And there's a sort of story that goes with that. The story goes that Kelvin was attending a lecture on the circulation theorems of Helmholtz. And the lecture involved a demonstration, right, actually done by Tate, Peter Gashly Tate. This is not Tate, actually. This is Dustin Kleckner, who's a postdoc, who's responsible for a lot of the work you're going to see in the second part of the talk. But nonetheless, the demonstration involved the creation of these sort of beautiful vortex rings, okay, which sort of propagate with stability and sort of very elegant evolution. And the lecture was about circulation theorems, which tell you that in a perfect fluid, if you make these things, you can't break them. So once you've made them, there's nothing you can do. And this was, of course, the time when the ether was still in fashion, and nobody really knew what atoms were. And so the idea was there, atoms must be knots tied in vortices in the ether. And the idea is that then you have this simple building block, you can construct all this complexity out of this simple building block, and you can imagine having the spectra being vibrational modes and all sorts of things. And this got Tate very excited, who started classifying knots to see if there could be a map. And then, of course, we all know, this didn't grow to become the established theory of atoms. But nonetheless, the seed was planted, the table was there, and then the table needed dealing with. And this was sort of the beginning of posed a lot of problems, which then was the beginning of knot mathematics, or at least played a significant role in its development.
Razor. I was asking
about the razor. Okay. Now, since then, that was sort of the beginning. Since then, it's sort of grown into its own field and come back into physics in many ways. In fact, in a lot of very interesting places, in hydrodynamics, in plasma physics, in high-energy physics. And you're going to hear a little more about all the places in which it's sort of come back over the last maybe 30 years in Mark's talk later on. What I want to do is sort of jump to the last 2 years and to just sort of point out that there's been a sort of growing interest, but not driven by the fact that we can actually do experiments on this sort of structure. And in particular, here's some work which I'm going to talk about in the first part of my talk, in which we studied, this is theory, but it could be done in experiment. We studied knotted structures in electromagnetic fields. This is a story you're going to hear about later on from Mark, in which he studied optical vortices in a scalar light field, both in theory and experiment. And then there's, of course, the work we heard about on Monday, tying knots in defect lines in liquid crystals, and some work which we're going to be hearing about again. You heard it in Brian's talk, but it's going to come back. And all these are very different systems, but they're all physically accessible, and they all have a common sort of set. They all pose a common set of challenges. The things that we tie are different. Here are the electric field lines, magnetic field lines. Here it's vortices, lines of zero intensity. Here it's directors, and here it's disclinations. But in all these cases, we have a problem. We have a problem of sort of coming up with the initial state. Is it possible to have an initial state which is topologically non-trivial? If so, how do you create it? How do you construct it? Once you've done that, what are the energetics? What are the rules? Is it stable? Is it going to have an existence of its own? How do they couple to each other? And what I'm going to try to do is sort of emphasize where these questions come in what I'm going to say. And I was going to say I'm going to put on Ken's hat. But unfortunately, this morning he showed up in a different hat. I'm going to put, because I learned a lot of these tricks about how to construct fields from him. But anyway, I'm going to put the hat on of a topological designer and kind of give you what I think are the design criteria for what I'm doing. So let's talk about the first part, which is knots in light in free space. And just to, again, tie it in to some of the things we were talking about yesterday, the sort of table that Mark and I constructed. I'm going to tell you about flows. I'm going to tell you about flows which are engineered, although they're occasionally spontaneous. I'm going to tell you about flows which are dynamic, where the dynamics of the structure is very important. And I'm going to tell you about a linear system in light. And so, as I said, the degree of freedom which I'm interested in tying and studying are field lines. And most of us have sort of first witness field lines, perhaps in an experiment like this. You have a magnet and some iron filings, and the iron filings align in the direction of the field. And these lines which are formed, they're a representation of the magnetic field. And the magnetic field is tangent everywhere to these lines. So these are the integral curves of the field. And usually you consider these in experiments involving matter, but when it comes to light, you sort of drop this description, because most of light, or at least the way we think about light, the first assumption you make is that it's essentially a plane wave. Laser beams are essentially a plane wave, which is then modulated, but the polarization structure is trivial. It's characterized by more useful variables like wavelengths and directions. But what I want to sort of, what I want you to entertain is the possibility of having light fields whose defining and most interesting structure or property is the structure of the field lines itself. And in particular, we're going to look at, of course, structures which are linked and knotted. And so we're going to need a way to sort of quantify that. And of course, many people over here know the story very, very, very well. But let me just sort of remind ourselves. You can characterize the extent of linking between two curves by a number, the linking number. You can calculate this sort of visually by inspection by taking two curves, giving them an orientation, and sort of projecting them on a plane, and then looking at all the crossings. And at each crossing, you have an orientation, which, if you want, comes from a cross product. But there's many ways of thinking about this. You then take all these crossings, you add up the signs, you divide by two, and you get a number. And this number characterizes the linking between the two curves. And this number is invariant, of course, under diffeomorphisms, anything reasonable that you do to the curves. But we, of course, have a field. We don't just have two ropes, two pieces of rope, or two lines. We're going to be filling space with the field lines of the electric and the magnetic field. And so we're going to need something which characterizes the knottedness and the linkedness in the whole field. And the thing which does that is actually exciting, a sort of quantity which has physical meaning by itself. It's the helicity. A over here is the vector potential. B, in this case, is the magnetic field. And this would be the magnetic helicity. There's also an electric helicity in free space, because you can swap sort of electric and magnetic fields in free space.
What's A, the electric helicity?
You can call it C, where E equals curl C. In free space, Maxwell's equations, you can just interchange by duality. And so what I want to just briefly do is convince you that this quantity, in fact, measures the average knottedness and linkedness of the field by starting with the expression which Randy told us about on Monday for the Gauss linking integral, which tells you how linked a pair of curves are, and just sort of guiding you through, at least heuristically, to convince you that these two are similar. So we have over here the sort of tangent to one curve, the tangent to another curve, and the line joining the two curves. Okay. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the field, we're going to imagine breaking it up into tubes. Each tube has a flux associated with it. And we're going to take the weighted sum of the linking number between all pairs of flux tubes, where each term is weighted by the flux in the tube. It's a sort of average linking number of the field. And so if you sort of put the gas linking integral in here and you sort of work it out, what you find is an expression. If you take the limit where the number of tubes goes to infinity and the flux goes to zero, you find an expression that looks something like this. Okay. And this is, of course, very, very familiar. It looks very similar to, it comes from a gas linking integral, but it's not only over two lines anymore, it's over a whole manifold of lines. Okay. And then the last step is very simple. You spot, you sort of essentially realize that a fraction of this expression over here is actually an expression for the vector potential that corresponds to the magnetic field. And so then you come back to the Hilbert scheme. So this measures kind of linking in a field. And so one of the first questions you want to ask when you see this is, okay, under what circumstances is linking conserved? Is this a conserved quantity? The helicity is important in all sorts of contexts, like plasma physics or hydrodynamics, in which there are conservation laws. What about free space? And so you can, to figure it out, you essentially take the time derivative of it, and you can simplify using Maxwell's equations. And here you immediately get a hint of what's to come. As soon as you do this, as soon as you're asking, is the magnetic helicity conserved, you see the electric fields comes into the story. So we started thinking about magnetic field lines, but actually we have to think about two fields, the electric and the magnetic. And so if you do this, basically just simple algebra takes you down to this expression over here. The time derivative of the helicity is proportional to the integral of the dot product between the electric and magnetic field averaged over space. So this is our first sort of design consideration or rule. If you want to have electromagnetic fields where this helicity is conserved, you need to engineer them so that this is true. But now, of course, you know, helicity measures an average. So you could have, imagine a field where you have sort of types of knots over here, different types over there. You could have all sorts of things. It would be very nice if you could have a field where all the field lines are representative of a particular link or a particular knot. And then the helicity is just sort of giving you a representation. It's essentially just the sum of things which are the same, which is the linking number between two objects which are the same. And it turns out that this is possible, and this is going to be a substantial part of what I'm going to tell you about. And the structure of the field lines is one which Randy drew on the board the other day. It's a Hopf vibration. And since it's going to appear a lot, I'm just going to remind you how to construct it so that we all know what we're looking at when we look at the evolution of these fields.
When it slowly down, can you go back one just to the helicity makes sense for all sorts of things, not just the E&M. And so
yes,
there's a question that's sort of being begged. I mean, because for hydrodynamics, I can think of B maybe as the velocity field or something. What's the thing that couples naturally?
Well, in that case, if you ask what the time derivative of the helicity is, it doesn't work the same because the underlying equations are not Maxwell's equations. Okay. So you don't necessarily need to introduce a conjugate field.
That's fine. So somehow implicit is this conjugate field. So there's something about the Lorentz invariance.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And that's the point I'm really going to come back to.
So I just want to ask you again, is there any other system that's naturally like this? I mean, is there a gravitational analog of this? I'm just wondering what it just seems. This is the first I've ever seen this rate of change of helicity for Maxwell's equations, I confess. So this is surprising.
In the limit of small velocities, you can rewrite the equations of general relativity to look almost exactly like Maxwell's equations,
right?
With instead of 4 pi, we have 16 pi.
But it's important also, it's completely source free, so this is, there's nothing else going on in these fields, no matter.
Well, I just wonder what the other things I should be thinking of is the analogs of E, because I sort of know what to do there in terms of
That's a good question. I mean, the two cases that I've sort of studied are the Maxwell case and the hydrodynamic case. In the hydrodynamic case, there's no kind of conjugate field. And a lot of the other cases are a combination of the two. Magnetohydrodynamics, you have the magnetic field, but you don't really worry too much about the electric field.
There's an analog in ferromagnetic materials where you can define magnetic electricity. That's conserved.
So let me describe this basic structure which we're going to build a lot on. So what I'm going to sort of construct for you, many of you are familiar with the Hopf vibration, but I'm just going to sort of walk through it. The basic building block for filling space with these field lines in field lines such that, sort of defining properties that we're going to fill space with field lines such that any two field lines are closed, and any two field lines are linked to each other. So it's electric field lines linked with electric field lines, or magnetic field lines linked with magnetic field lines. I'm not talking about linking between them. And the basic building block for this structure is a torus, the one which I've drawn over here. And the basic sort of first step, the key step which you make in constructing the structure, is you draw a curve that goes once around one circumference of the torus and once around the other circumference of the torus. And you do that. You can do that with one curve, and then you realize that you can in fact take a second curve, and you can draw a curve which goes once around one circumference and once around the other circumference. And you can do this smoothly without having them run into each other. And if you do that, I guess I'm not quite as skilled as Randy in this sort of demonstration, but here we go. Okay. Well, okay, you get the idea. And here we go. Okay, so you do this, and you can keep on doing this. Okay, the nice thing is that you can keep on doing this, you can keep on drawing circles, and you can in fact make up the whole surface of the torus with these circles. Then you can get rid of this torus, and what you're left with is a collection of circles that foliate, but form the surface of the torus. And any two of these curves are linked to any two other two. And then you can sort of nest these inside each other, and you have tori where everybody's linked to everybody on each torus, and then you just have to sort of notice that everyone on every torus is linked to everyone on other torus. And that's sort of easy to do if you consider, you know, the inner torus, every field line goes at least once around the circumference over here, and on the outer one, everybody goes at least once around the circumference over here. So everybody on inside is linked to everybody outside, vice versa. So your field structure is now lines that fill space with any two linked to each other. And I'm going to be representing, you know, of course it's an intricate structure, but you can represent its structure very simply just using two lines. A straight line, which is sort of the infinitely big torus, it's the line around the infinitely big torus, and a circle, which is at the core of this whole structure. And from that, and maybe, you know, one representative set just to help you fill out space, you get an immediate kind of idea of how these lines fill space. You can form the rest of the picture yourself. And this kind of structure has a very simple representation in terms of a complex function. And there's various ways of thinking about this, constructing this. You can use different coordinates on the three sphere. If you want, what I'm doing is representing this whole structure with a map from S3 to S2, and we're looking at the level sets of this map. But in kind of Cartesian coordinates, it looks something like this. And these circles, it's just a complex phase everywhere in space. And these circles correspond to points of, or lines, pre-images, lines of constant amplitude and phase of this map. And the tori corresponds to areas, circles of constant amplitude, and the rest of the structure you can put together. And this is kind of a key step in the whole process. At least one way to think of a key step. This is where you've designed or you've encoded the knottedness, and it's where you can use maps between spaces in order to try and construct an initial state. And so, for example, this is where you could imagine using different types of maps to construct more intricate linking. And you'll hear later in Mark's talk about the construction he used just to generate the complex phase itself. But you can then take this and put it into a construction to generate an electromagnetic field. And then you can generate kind of field lines, which are knotted and linked. So this is where the design comes in. But what I'm going to do is before we go and talk about generalizations, focus on this structure over here. And it turns out this field has sort of appeared time and time again in the literature in very different contexts over the years. It goes back to Bateman in the early 1900s, later studied by Robertson Troutman, and more recently by Ivo, and also by Ragnada. And you know, you can sort of imagine a joke about how many years have to pass before something's rediscovered or recycled. But really what's going on is that with each of these steps, there was a different aspect of the structure which was being emphasized or understood in these solutions. So you start out with just trying to solve Maxwell's equations with complex potentials. Later, the relativistic structure was being emphasized. They were trying to understand problems with, to do with the topology of space-time. And then later, Lagnada was trying to kind of look at electromagnetism from an exterior form point of view in constructing solutions. And the very recent work, the sort of perspective which I want to try to add to this, is to think of this as literally a design problem and try and figure out where in all this structure over here lie the rules for these fields. Where do the rules for what's possible and not possible in knotted light? So rather than sort of take you through derivation of the full expression, I'm just going to jump in and show you what the field does. Okay, and just to relate the field which I'm going to show you, which is, let's say, the electric field or the magnetic field, it's related to this structure. It's sort of given by this expression over here at time zero. Okay, we have a gradient of this map, of this function. We have a gradient of its conjugate. So the cross product points along lines of constant amplitude and phase. And this is sort of essentially how we construct the field. And then we can treat this as an initial value problem for Maxwell field, and we can solve for the time evolution. And what you see over here is the electric field at time zero, the magnetic field at time zero. And what I want to show you now is what happens when you turn time on, when we let this field evolve. And this is what happens. So what you see is this sort of structure deforms. It doesn't stay isometrically what it was at the beginning. It sort of seems to propagate, mainly in one direction, and it twists. But the remarkable thing is that the field line structure, the topology of the field line structure, is perfectly preserved. Okay, this solution evolves very, very smoothly with no accident.
So it starts out very symmetric and ends up asymmetric. Is that just some anomaly or?
Well, that's where our other friend, the magnetic field, comes in. Because you have the symmetric structure for E, and then you have B, and now you have E cross B, and that breaks the symmetry.
So the E and B and the evolution remain everywhere orthogonal, so it's pointwise vanishing? Is the helicity preserved?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But for the moment, we're just going to focus on the fact that the integral is zero. We'll come back to that detail later. It's a very important detail.
Time in reverse. In other words, if you reverse the direction of magnetic
field, entropy.
It goes backwards. It's completely coherent. You can flip time around and it just goes backwards.
But it deforms similarly.
Yes. It actually comes from deformed into sort of what I call a phase locked coherent structure and then goes out again. In fact, we'll see that in a minute.
Do they preserve the E2B? Duality
asymmetry
or other like spatial reflection
symmetries
into that?
Yes. I mean, they're physical solutions of Maxwell's equations. Effectively, the duality is actually quite important, as we'll see later on. You sort of have E turning into B and B turning into E about this pointing field, which I'm not talking about. Okay. And you know, this kind of, once you get out here, it looks kind of tangled, or at least it's not immediately obvious to see what the structure is. What I want to just try and do is give you a way to summarize this. We're going to look at this evolution from the top. You see it evolves going forward. There's this twist and this rotation. But if you look at it carefully from the top, you see that, in fact, most of the deformation happens in this initial stage. The structure evolves, deforms, and twists. But then it essentially just expands. So what you have seen in this video is the entire evolution of the field. From here on, it essentially just keeps on expanding. And this line slowly asymptotes to a 90-degree twist in the field. So you can really kind of understand the entire evolution of this field with a simple picture. OK, so that was the field lines. But field lines are one thing. What about energy? What about the energy density? What's going on with the sort of more physical aspect of the field? And so what I'm showing you over here is a cross-section in the three planes of the energy density at time t equals 0. Okay, there's three slices, and this is an isosurface of the energy density. It's sort of an initial time drops off as 1 over r to the 8. And if we turn time on, okay, if you turn time on, you see that this ball of energy evolves preferentially in one direction, which is given by the E cross B symmetry, and it sort of expands, and it almost looks like a sort of opening umbrella, I think, to the structure. And of course, if you turn time back, like Shura would like to do, it comes into focus and then comes out again. So you see, it very much has the form of a pulsed beam of light, which comes down to a focus and comes out of a focus. And in fact, this makes you think, you know, you can realize it, in fact, in experiment. And I think you can, right? And we even have a suggestion on how to do it. But at the moment, I just want to focus on the geometric property. So here's just a composite picture where you're looking at the energy density and the field line structures evolving. So that's the sort of plot of what the energy density does. What about numbers? What properties does this beam have? Well, it has energy, of course. Has momentum, it moves preferentially in Z. Has angular momentum, which actually encodes this twist. And I also included a couple of charges here which normally aren't used that much in electromagnetism, because in free space you have the symmetry in electromagnetism, conformal invariance, which you don't have when you have charges. But conformal structure plays an important role in these solutions. And so I included the Noether currents which you get from the conformal boosts, and then non-zero, and that's all I want to note at the moment. Okay, so this thing exists and it has these properties, and it's quite remarkable.
And E is the energy density, not the modulus of the E vector.
It's, yes, energy density. Real field.
You have bold E and normal E.
In the boost vector.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
That's energy.
Yes, absolutely. So what I want to do now is I want to sort of try and take this thing apart, a sort of very, very physicist sort of instinct. Let's break it up into some basis, and let's see if we can understand how this thing is put together. Because it's a remarkable solution which has appeared in all these contexts, but what are the mechanics of it? What are the rules for it? And so what I want to do is break it down into a basis. And I tried all sorts of bases. It turns out that even though the structure doesn't look very spherical at all, spherical basis is a very good one. And you get a hunch sort of for that from the fact that there's this rotation. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to break down the field into a superposition of these basis states over here, vector spherical harmonics. All you really want to know about them is that they're characterized by an angular momentum L and a projection of the angular momentum M. And there's two polarizations, because light has these two polarizations. So you have a TE and the basis and a TM basis. And a general field is really a general superposition of all these basis states. But if you figure out what the decomposition of the solution I just showed you is in this basis, you find the following. It's actually quite simple. All those summation signs over all L and M have disappeared. The solution has a simple kind of L is 1, M is 1. And that's the only component which appears here. The two polarizations appear with an equal weight, with a phase factor of I, E and TM. And the energy spectrum is very simple. It's just omega e to the minus omega. And so this simple, somehow this basis set has to have a role, tells us something about how this solution works. So what I want to do now is I want to sort of look at this decomposition and see how we can put it back together. So the first thing I want to point out is, what's special about this? What's special about this phase factor in optics? Phase factors, engineering phase factors, is often the key to the game. So let's see if we can understand that. And you can do that by taking the curl of this expression over here. And if you take the curl of this expression over here, you find that you get the same expression back, just multiplied by a real number. So these states are, in fact, eigenstates of the curl operator. These are sort of very nice functions. I think Randy mentioned them the other day. They appear in a lot of places. They're very natural functions when you're working with fields that involve co-operators. But what do they have to do with knottedness? What do they have to do with linking? Well, the helicity was an integral of A dot curl A. And you can imagine that if A is an eigenstate of the curl operator, then there's going to be maximal overlap between curl A and A. And so somehow, by using these states, you're maximizing the linking in the field.
Electronic fields.
Huh?
These are electronic
fields. Yes.
Electronic fields.
Very important thing.
Bertani is that it's proportional to F, and Schaul is when it's constant. Oh, not right.
Okay.
Times F.
So that's a sort of algebraic reason. What about the geometry of these objects over here? And here I'm just drawing you field lines about one of these building blocks. Okay, because I want to get to the rules. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw a field line starting at some point in this field. These fields depend on space, so different points might give you different things. We're going to start over here, and I'm just going to draw the field lines for a single frequency component of this field. And if you do that, you see that you get a structure which is knotted. You can then start from different points, and you can construct different field lines. And what you rapidly find is that this object over here, in fact, contains all torus knots. It contains all kind of possible combinations of P and Q in the torus knots, and it also contains irrational ones. So it's really something which has a lot of structure in it. And then what sort of makes it tick, or what makes it lock into this Hopf structure, is the energy spectrum. And this is something we're sort of trying to understand at the moment. I still don't have a very clear picture of why this is so, but it's a remarkable sort of kind of correspondence between the geometry and the energy spectrum of the field. And it's a little bit of a mystery why exactly it does that. Okay, so we've taken it apart. We've seen a little bit what role it played in that solution. Let's try and use it to engineer things. So the next thing which I'm going to do is just write a general field as a superposition of all possible of these Kerr eigenstates and calculate the helicity. And when you do that, you find that you get two terms. Okay. One term is time dependent, which we don't want. We don't want the helicity to change. But fortunately, you spot the pattern. Right? It has coefficients for L and minus M multiplying L and M. So if you only make a superposition of coefficients of vector spheric harmonics with pure M, you're going to have a time-independent helicity. And the other thing is that, well, the positive helicity contributes positively, the negative helicity contributes negatively in the time-independent part. So if you want to engineer, you just choose one of these and one of these, and you'll be good. The helicity will be conserved, and it'll be non-zero. And so then you can use that to design. And here's one example where we just took simplest thing you can do, just put L is 2, M is 2. You get tangles. Okay, these tangles aren't quite as beautiful as the one which we saw before. I'm going to come back to one of those in a minute. But they nonetheless contain field lines with linking and knotting structure. And if you look at these field lines carefully, you find that at least for L is 2, M is 2, there's a strong kind of participation of trefoil knots. But it's also possible to play another game. And this is a very instructive game, at least it was for me, where you say, okay, I'm going to, for the moment, ignore what I looked at in terms of composing it only with one plus and minus. I'm going to take a superposition of right and left so that I have still time-independent helicity. That's important, but that I maybe reduce a little bit the maximum I could have had, but I do that in exchange for engineering a very coherent field. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put a ratio in between these two components of P and Q. Remember, this component took us around this way, and this component took us around this way. So if I put a ratio in there, I can in fact construct all possible torus knots. I can construct all the whole table of torus knots, and I can do it coherently throughout the field, just like we had before that Hopf structure, where we had a link on every torus field space. Here we can do trefoil knots. And the helicity is conserved. So great, you know, we have a rule for engineering and we can use it. The problem is when you look at it and you try to figure out how these field lines evolve, you run into a catastrophe. As soon as you turn time on, as soon as you let these field lines evolve, the evolution is not smooth like we saw before, but they sort of unravel and they completely break apart. Mm-hmm. Even though the helicity, which is the average measure, is preserved. And so to understand the difference and understand what's going on, we sort of took a step back and considered, well, in what sense can I think of a field line as something which is evolving smoothly, as something which is unbreakable, as something which is like a filament? And you can basically do that if you can embed the evolution, if you can map the evolution of the field as if it were brought about by a fluid. So you draw these field lines in the fluid. You have a velocity field for the fluid, which sort of deforms space everywhere. And as long as that's smooth, then the field lines can't break apart. And physically, that sort of corresponds to demanding that essentially if you move along the field line and then get transported by the velocity, or transported by the velocity with a time-changed field, then you close, you commute. And if this commutation is true, then your field lines evolve like in the first case, not in the second case. Their identity is preserved in time. And so you can take this commutator, and again, you can simplify it using free space Maxwell's equations, and you can put in a velocity field, a reasonable velocity field, which is the pointing field, like normalized so that everything goes at the speed of light locally. And when you do that, you find that this condition over here is satisfied if E dot B is zero everywhere, not the integral of E dot B is zero. And under this circumstance, then your field lines have a smooth evolution. And this is a much stronger design constraint. And this is sort of at the heart of what I think the problem is for field line evolution in free space field. In fact, you'll recognize that as a sort of condition that the field is null. And so we have this combination here where both E dot B is zero and the integral is zero and everything's hunky-dory. E dot B is zero, but locally it's not, and things fall apart. And so the engineering problem is really not only engineering E dot B is zero. That's pretty hard. Okay? But it's worse than that. It has to stay zero, which means that the evolution has to not change the angles between vectors, okay? Which means you need a conformal evolution for the field to survive. Okay? And so the thing which is doing that is, of course, the pointing field. And so let's go back and look at the pointing field. And if you look at the pointing field, these are now the lines of the pointing field. They are also hot vibration. At time zero, it coincides with the electric and magnetic field, which we saw before. But as you let time evolve, you find that, in fact, this configuration moves away from the energy density. It stays rigid, unlike the electric and magnetic one, but it moves sort of through the focus of energy density in the direction opposite to the energy flow.
Can I just make a comment?
Yeah.
The most important thing on that slide is the indefinite article in front of HOP.
Yeah.
I just wanted to point out, I mean, you know, there are lots of, there's a two-sphere worth of HOP vibrations.
Yes.
You sort of pointed out the sort of the orthonormal basis for the ways B and
P
plus B are pointing vector.
Yes. And so that's sort of the key to the problem. The key is that you want to engineer magnetic field lines in free space, but you have to worry about all this additional structure in order to get it to evolve and have a sort of meaningful evolution. And so you start, that's one of the design kind of problems which we face. You start with one thing, and then you discover that the constraints tell you that what you're engineering is not really that object, but something which is a little more complex.
Can I just add, I mean, inspired by Shura's point yesterday, I mean, we were talking about entropy. So, I mean, if you're talking, we don't have an entropy for an electromagnetic field, we can ask how stable it is if
yes.
we were going to, say, do it in an experiment.
Yes.
So because the bright part of the light is moving away from this invariant structure,
yes.
do you have any feeling about, you know, if you were going to perturb the field somehow, say, in a real experiment, would that be stable or would that sort of untangle itself?
Well, I think generally it's linear, right? And in many linear cases, by superposition, you can break things. And so as soon as you come away from the energy, the structure, yes, is not going to be very robust.
But you don't know how it sort of does entangle.
I don't know how it's going to do that. But the electric and magnetic ones follow the energy. So as long as your perturbation is small compared to that, then.
But that's the invariant. That's the thing that looks invariant.
That's just so the pointing field is an invariant hot vibration. Is that what I'm saying?
It's, yes.
Yeah, so that's really because it's the momentum. Right?
Yes. And what it's doing is, in fact, it's pushing along these field lines everywhere, and it's pushing them along. You can ask, how do they actually evolve? It's pushing them along in straight lines, along geodesics. So if you look at what this pointing field is achieving, is it's pushing your electromagnetic field in along these straight lines, which means that you can reduce the whole kind of problem if you can ensure that E dot B is zero to start with. It reduces the whole problem to a time zero design problem. You need to design an initial configuration, and you need to make sure that this configuration is orthogonal, and you need to make sure that the pointing field for this configuration is shear free. In other words, these evolution lines don't suffer from shear.
You know what these constraints look like if you go to twist the space?
They simplify a little bit, and that's one of the kind of ways in which you can construct this sort of field. He was an expert on this.
So can I ask sort of a related question that's also related to Randy's thing? So you're doing this in the Minkowski space, but,
yes.
but somehow the picture, I really want to use this sitter space and not take the string out of projection of the hub field, but just work in S3.
Yes, you can map. I mean, it's again, this conformal invariance allows you to map.
So in the sitter space, is this essentially just a plane, you know, plane, whatever that means, wave.
Something like that. Yes, it's an elementary. In fact, as Ivo showed in one of the articles, you can obtain this structure by a slightly sophisticated version of an inversion. Okay. So from a plane wave. So and this structure is, in fact, well known.
A plane wave.
Yeah. That's what I was getting. Yeah.
Exactly. But somehow it brings together all these constraints.
From shear free, you mean that the divergence is here, right?
No. From shear free, I mean that if you look at the evolution between neighboring geodesics, there is no change in angle of something which is transported along.
But for this, when you wrote this equation, which passes from the kernel of E cross
yes.
E to the G derivative, you are assuming that the divergence of the pointing vector is zero.
Yes.
Okay, so
that's another constraint. Yes. All the usual Maxwell constraints apply. Yes.
No, but not B, not the magnetic field.
Oh, the velocity field itself. Yes. Yes.
Have also divergence, zero divergence.
Yes.
But not only a zero time, but for any time. Because I think that if you have the pointing vector has zero divergence at T zero, it does not need to be preserved.
It will be physically because there's no sources of energy.
But he's talking about the velocity field, not the pointing field.
Yeah, you're talking about velocity field.
You normalize the pointing field and then it's a okay, anyway. So that's sort of coming to the conclusion of this first part of the talk. I'll just sort of.
I have a question for you after you conclude the first part.
Okay. This is a special solution. It tells us about how to design this sort of field. It tells us that it's a very strongly constrained problem, and that's something which we're sort of really working on at the moment. This gentleman over here is spending a lot of time thinking about this problem. And some of the things which we're doing is really trying now that we've figured out these rules, is really trying to find ways of generalizing these solutions so that you can engineer arbitrary knotting and linking in this very tightly constrained problem. And there's a whole story which I didn't want to go into, which is of how you might actually make these in experiment. I think it's possible. We suggested a way in which we want to do that. But what I want to do now is sort of change gears and talk about a different system, which is a fluid. But
no, just to memorize. So the density, the helicity density,
yes,
equals zero. Allows you to do what exactly is a constraint for what?
For the smooth evolution of field lines.
For the smooth evolution.
Yes. Which so you can conserve helicity, but you can have field lines change topology. Mm-hmm. And as long as
interesting, because it's basically we're talking about Frobenius condition, and that's related to integrability.
Yes.
Of systems.
Exactly.
In general.
Exactly.
So that's very interesting.
Exactly. So it's essentially some sort of integrability.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
But you have to impose other conditions. It's not enough to have that E times B is zero.
Yes.
You have to impose.
Because it has to be preserved.
Yes. Which are difficult. I mean, they are not trivial at all. It's the divergence of the pointing vector being zero for any time is a.
It's a very strong constraint.
Local and very strong condition.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons I think the solution illustrates some of the challenges, and it sort of pulls together some of the problems which come together when you try to engineer these knotted structures in fields, not just in ropes. You have dynamical constraints. You don't just have the freedom to which you have when you take a piece of rope.
I have a question. Can I ask a question?
You can ask a question.
I need the chalkboard that was annotated.
You need the chalkboard?
That's the question.
Okay.
Turn the light on this side.
No, don't turn the light on. Do not turn the light.
So maybe I'm just confused, but if you have flux lines like in a superconductor or in the center of a star, right? The force is proportional to J cross B.
Mm-hmm.
So you have current. You have current in a magnetic field, and then what? I guess this is Maxwell's equation, mm-hmm. right? You agree? Right, and then there's this one, which is London's equation. So, if you want to, you can actually have a configuration where there are no forces on flux lines.
Yes.
Right, which also satisfies these are Kroll eigenfields.
Okay.
Right. So, why can't you construct that? Wouldn't that be easier and more interesting? on a more interesting, sorry. To native current.
Yes.
So this is another example, Rob, you just asked, right? Where you have current, right? And J.B is the work that's being done by the, right? It's a work.
So, but his solutions were source free, right? J was zero. And
yep. Yeah. But now J is a different thing, right? See, it's
Yeah.
No, you said the question asked it very early on.
I'm answering it now, right? So you could imagine in like, so cores of stars are supposed to be superconducting. So
yes.
Say like neutron stars.
Yes.
So you can imagine current field configurations like this.
Yes.
So can you create those in the lab?
Good question. We'll wait and see. But actually, that's one of the questions where this work is also going, which is, you know, once you have a beam with funny properties, which you can make, you can shine it on things, and you can try to think about the transfer of some of these properties when you put it onto something.
Okay, can I ask something? So I think Randy was asking in the lab more like as an astrophysicist maybe than as a.
So you can actually buy supercomputers. You can buy them.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you just want to look at, you know.
No, from scientific, stuff. You can buy superconductors. Okay.
So let me ask a slightly different question, and I can ask it more creatively. You are proposing that you might see any knots there, but there's a the torus knots, of course, are these links of certain very special algebraic
curves
in C2, and there's a class that slightly generalizes that they're kind of like torus knots, and they're all sort of twisting one way.
Okay.
But they're not torus knots.
Okay.
So I'll be mentioning that in my talk.
Good. Okay. So that's what I said.
No. So
maybe that's the class. Maybe it's not all of them, but some class like that that's more.
That's preserved. Yes. No. That it's essentially to a large extent an open question. What solutions can exist? I've just tried to sort of set up some of the rules. And
there's this ancient paper by Campbell and Evers. It's a huge ancient paper. It's really cute because it's about force reconfigurations of flux lines. And it says in there, they try to construct the force reconfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
All they can think is like twisting some braids around. They say, but obviously we can't fill space with this.
Okay.
And they stop. That's it. You know, I mean, there's lots of other things. They're interested in natural physics of the flux lines, but they just stop. They say, well, so we can have a very thin wire,
mm-hmm.
maybe. Right? But that's it, because we can't fill space with it. Right? And so here's a way of doing that.
Okay, so this was sort of, you know, as I said before, linear and more of a sort of way to explore some of one of the questions you ask when you think about a complicated problem is what's the linear case gives you? What structures can you have in a linear structure? And now I want to switch to a nonlinear case. I want to switch to experiments. We're going to switch to experiments in fluids. We're going to be watching a lot of movies of experiments in fluids.
Can you please turn on the light off? We're going to watch movies.
I turned it off.
This other one,
maybe the other one. Okay, here we go. Okay, so we're going to be moving from electromagnetism to fluid mechanics, which clearly also plays a central role in physics. If I can quote and so on. So we go back to our diagram over here. We're going to be talking about filaments now. I'm not going to be talking about flows. I'm not going to be talking about so much focusing on filling space without defects in them. I'm going to be talking about flows which are organized by defects, by filaments. We're going to be engineering them, although to some extent I think these structures can occur spontaneously. They're dynamic again, but now they're nonlinear and they involve matter. Okay. And just as a sort of parenthesis, this sort of partly part of the motivation for this sort of looking at this sort of problem in hydrodynamics comes again from helicity, but now it's hydrodynamic helicity, and it pops up in a lot of complex flows, including turbulent flows, as a way to sort of maybe try and get an insight and understand certain classes of complex flows, both in magnetohydrodynamics and in hydrodynamics and in superfluids. Okay, so. Just to sort of split the two talks and give us all a little breathing space, I want to show you a movie, which is a very famous movie on YouTube. Okay. This has actually played a role in the development of this project. Because, you know, nobody, despite this Kelvin being the origin of all this, and it being such an important problem for all these reasons, nobody has ever managed to make, until recently, a vortex knot. Okay? And so that sounded like a very good first project to start working on. And I was, of course, a little bit worried. Right? And I started worrying and worrying, and I talked to a lot of people. And then I saw this movie over here, and you see this, and you get the feeling this must be possible. There's got to be the freedom to get this to work.
They read Kelvin's paper.
How come we didn't get this?
Think of the average.
We couldn't get a reply. He said he was too busy.
I showed this video once at some talk, and somebody asked me a very good question, which I didn't know the answer to. Do those dolphins know how to do it, or do other dolphins teach them?
Yes, so another person here has broken the cube pen, and apparently one of them knew how to do it, but then the knowledge spreads.
So like the dolphin taught the other ones, not
right,
the
right. Dolphins. They put him in like a pool, and then he taught other dolphins how to do it.
Yeah. So if we can teach one to make a knot.
You need the
Einstein dolphins. Or just one that likes to travel amongst friends.
Yeah, he's working on the problem of quantum gravity.
Okay, so we're going to take these vortex loops, like the one that you just saw, and we're going to try and tie them into knots. Okay? Of course, you know, this problem has a rich history. You could think of, you know, where do you start? You could think of doing all sorts of knots. And I'm going to focus on torus knots. Okay? I'm going to start by focusing on this guy over here. It's the simplest kind of knot. That's one good reason. But the other one is that there's some sort of analytical work that have been done on this. I mean, this is a strong approximation which you can make to the motion of vortex lines in a fluid. You essentially say that you make the so-called local induction approximation. The vortex line moves just like a ring moves. Okay? And small rings go faster, big rings go slower. And if you have a complicated shape, you just fit a ring locally to every point, and it goes in that direction with that curvature. So the motion of the vortex filament is in the direction of the binormal and proportional to the curvature everywhere. Okay. And if you make that approximation, you can construct one of these shapes that propagates in such a way as to not change its shape at all. And I've sort of shown it over here getting bigger and coming towards you. This vortex propagates without changing shape while rotating and coming towards you. And it's possible to do that. Kida did this analytically in the 80s. By finding just the right shape so that all these kind of binormal motions give you this coherent motion of the vortex. And this solution has been around for a while, and in fact its stability has been a topic of debate for a long time, with the latest contribution coming last year, where it's claimed to be unstable. Okay, but there's also kind of other work where, by going to the next order of approximation, the solution Renzo claims can be stabilized, essentially, by using Bio-Savart evolution instead of linear evolution.
So we can't expect the dolphins to. Expect the dolphins to do it sometime.
Maybe.
Renzo's right.
Have people done numerical simulations starting with all these initial conditions?
Yes, there was some numerical work. Unfortunately, in a regime in which the core size is very, very large. Because at the time, at least when they did it, that was a very hard problem, 256 cubed. And so with a very large core vortex, this approximation doesn't apply anymore, and you expect it to break down.
Okay, so they can't simulate anything that actually does that in the full flow?
Yes, as far as I know, no. I mean, no, they can't. Yes, they've tried. Okay, so how do you do it? Okay, you can sort of naively, you can imagine doing all sorts of ways. One is creating some complicated flow, and in fact, there are some people who tried that. And filtering the knots out. You could think of colliding things together, or you could think of making some shape which makes them. And this particular approach had received a lot of attention and was the subject of a lot of various attempts. And there was a recent suggestion by Renzo of a way to sort of make a trefoil knot by colliding two rings. And the basic idea was you make two rings, they're traveling one after the other, you perturb them, they approach each other, and when they approach each other, they interact in such a way as to have three reconnections, okay? And the result of that is a torus knot. So this seemed like a good starting point. So on day one, we made a very simple setup. It's a water tank. Okay? We have a box, and we have a hole in the box, and we can shape the hole in the box, and we generate some bubbles. The reason we generate the bubbles is that they act as a very good way to image the vorticity. And I'll show you over here just a vortex ring in our setup. So we just push a slug of fluid through the hole, and you get this vortex ring. And the bubbles act as very fine traces of the core of the vortex ring. They're much better than smoke, essentially because the vortex is locally, you have the fluid spinning like this, so the fluid wants to go out. If you have a bubble, it goes by buoyancy to the center of the ring, and you get a very clean picture. So one ingredient of Rentzel's suggestion was we need to shape them. Okay? So this is our attempt at creating a threefold perturbation. So we'll have to give it a second to accumulate the bubbles. But you see it's possible. It's not totally trivial, but it's possible to engineer the shape of a vortex. And this shape evolves very coherently. And in fact, this movie over here is a good way to sort of see qualitatively how this local induction approximation works. You see, what you see over here is what looks like an oscillation of an elastic filament. Right? But really what's going on, if you look from the side, is you have a three-dimensional evolution. Okay? What's happening is that the curved parts over here are going faster, so they come in like this. These parts over here are coming out, and so the whole thing is flapping. And exactly. And there you go. You see it out of plane and coming in of plane. And as it comes in and out of plane, you get this oscillation. Okay, so we can do that. The other thing we needed to do was shoot them at each other in a kind of clean way. This, of course, had been done before. And some beautiful experiments years ago, but we needed to see how we could do it in this system with this sort of imaging. And here are two rings. One fired after the other. You see, they like to interact with each other. Each one is moving in the flow field of the other. Okay? And this is also slight, for us, a little bit of, we have to improve our experiments to see this. This is a very delicate dance, if you want to see it.
Is there an external flow field, or is passive?
It needs to be passive. And the external flow fields perturb some things more than others. It's fairly robust, but if you want this sort of leapfrogging, you have to.
How do they keep moving in one direction because you keep perturbing on site?
No, you just push once, you push the second one, and then the first one sort of moving along happily with the fluid spinning like this. The second one gets caught and the fluid flow comes out. And then this one gets caught in that one's fluid flow, and so you get this oscillation. And so, you know, there are the ingredients. So we should be able to make a knot. We tried. And we tried, and we tried. And it's not so easy. In fact, it doesn't work. And the basic reason, I mean, we might be able to get it to work now, like we have some further insights, but at the time, it seemed like a real problem. And the basic reason you can see from this movie over here. So these are two rings, one next to the other. And you see, after they come out, they merge, okay? Which is what we want. We wanted reconnections in order to create the knot. But if you look at what happens, it's actually a fairly, quote unquote, you know, energetic, violent process. Like there's this huge perturbation that gets shot around the ring. And when you can imagine when you're trying to get these two finely shaped vortices to catch up with each other, interact in just the right way, this sort of thing is going to create a mess. So back to the drawing board. So now we went to plan B. And plan B was to try and create a nozzle, a shape, orifice, such that you push the vortex out of it, and it comes out already knotted. And so, well, you can see, this also involved a lot of trying. Here's attempt number 8. We have a rim over here of an orifice, which traces a trefoil knot. You have to worry about the self-intersection. We tried different approaches. We made holes. We put a barrier there. We tried all sorts of things. This is what we see. Getting there. Disaster. Looks promising. You look at that. You say, oh, I swear. No, it doesn't work. And we sort of stared at these, and we looked at a lot of these. And you stare at them, and you realize, well, why isn't this working? What's going on? Over here, it looks beautiful. You get the filament exactly as you wanted. It comes right off how you designed it, with the right curvature, goes in the right direction. Great. But over here, something bad happens. And if you look carefully, in this run over here, we had a few extra bubbles on the bottom. And what you see is that there's a vortex developing on this side. But that's the wrong side. That's the side we don't want these vortices on. So now you can see what's going on. You have a vortex created on this edge and one created on this edge. So effectively what you have is four holes. and you're shooting vortices at each other through these four holes, and you get this this problematic reconnection, and so that's causing it to fail. But this kind of was a bit of a breakthrough, because we finally realized, okay, you really have to face the music, and the music you have to face is that there's nothing you can do about this situation. You have to find a way around it. You're always going to have a situation where you have an open and an open side in your structure that creates a vortex, and you need to break symmetry. You need to make it so that the vortex comes off only one edge and not the other edge. And the shape which can achieve that is the shape that brought us all here together. It's a wing. A wing breaks symmetry. You sort of can think of the flow field around the wing as a steady flow field plus a circulation, and you get the lift from that. But that's, you know, a good picture which works, which tells you sort of how your link produces lift once you're in the air. When you're stationary, you have no circulation. When you're flying, you have circulation. But there's sort of constraints on circulation. You can't get it from nowhere. And so when you accelerate the wing, you need to compensate for that circulation. And you compensate for it by emitting a starting vortex. And so the idea is, now we're going to create a ring, a wing, effectively, and we're going to shape it into a ring. And we're then going to accelerate this wing, and we're going to see if it's possible to produce the starting vortex, to image the starting vortex, and use this to create vortices. We're not the first thing people to think about closed wings, but perhaps the first in this context. Here's a CAD design of the sort of final prototype. We make these by 3D printing. So this is a time-lapse image of how we actually make these structures. But this is the key movie.
It's just gravitation.
No. It's actually, this was a lot of fun. So this is where we started by, you know, pushing it a few G's. Then we got an electromagnetic motor. We did 20 G's. Then we really seriously sat down and had discussions about explosives and about all sorts of things. No, because it just wasn't quite going enough. And so we settled on, actually, we finally discovered that actually, if you really want to accelerate something, the best way to do it is with a big whack.
Yes.
So we now have weight-matched carts with controlled spring constants in between them, and we can do about 200 Gs. Much more than that, and we start breaking things. So you've seen the ring. Of course, this was the plan. And actually, you're probably one of the first audiences to see this. What I want to show you now, finally, it's not a story of failure, but what, to the best of our knowledge, is the first vortex.
No. I think you guys have a James Bond movie.
With a cavitation in it.
William Erlang.
Okay, I'll just show that again. We accelerate the structure. The filament comes off. And the structure is that of the
normal. How many G's are you accelerating that, you said?
This was one of the early ones. This was actually about between 20 and 50. We got better. I'll show you in a minute. Now, some of you might say, I don't believe you. You're showing me a 2D projection of a knot. It looks pretty unstable. We'll get to that. But also, you could question whether or not I'm showing you, you know, you can't tell if what's going in front of what from a 2D image.
Was Kiva? Did you start with that particular curve?
Yes.
So you're very careful to model that way.
Yes. And there's some subtleties. And so what I want to be able to do is have a three-dimensional picture of this field. So you can see, and I can convince you that we've made a knot. And so we built this kind of rig over here. It's a laser sheet. It scans back and forth. You synchronize it with a high-speed movie. So you take about 80,000 frames per second. You reconstruct the 3D data. This gives you about 500 volumetric images per second, which is roughly what you need. So we do that. Now I can show you a movie, but I can rotate it. And you can see the structure. Is that of a trefoil or not? Okay, so now we sort of have to play with it a little bit and see how robust this technique was. Does it work? Do we understand what's going on?
Given that you've been talking about, say, the theoretical solutions that people have looked at,
yes.
Have you compared what the theoretical solution of a vortex knot looks like to actually what you're generating?
Yes. Yes. So the local induction approximation, once you have finite cores, doesn't works qualitatively but not quantitatively, and you can get that not just from this movie but from the oscillating movie. It's roughly up by a factor of two in speeds. That doesn't necessarily mean it's up by a factor of two in ratios. So the comparison is sort of a little bit tricky because of this finite core.
Does it give you the right kind of squashedness?
Yes. So exactly. So that's the sort of question we want to ask now. And then the first thing which we did is what happens? How does the solution scale? Is it robust? Is the mechanism which we suggested the one which is at work? And so we made a few different sizes.
So that
ring should be linked with the template that you're using.
Yes.
So I'm wondering
what's happening.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's this part over here, which I didn't emphasize a lot, and it's kind of hard to see, but if you look right over here and right over here, we have to modulate the wing a little bit. So what
you
have is you have a vortex.
So I didn't see what you're doing.
There's a slight modulation in the wing shape over here.
Yeah.
So what you have is you create this vortex by acceleration,
right,
and it's bound to the vorticity around the structure.
Right.
But then if you modulate the structure, you can sort of reduce the vorticity a little bit locally, and you can pull this through the other vortex, because the vorticity is bound to the wing.
So the scaling I figured it was not a global scaling. Your wing is pretty big. I mean, why don't you have like a little bit? It's the same length, but it's a little tiny cross section. And then it accelerated rapidly, so you can generate, maybe it breaks too easily. That's a
pretty strong one.
That's a strong one. And it broke the first time you, yeah.
Okay. So, but what we did is scaling not just by scaling the overall shape, we also scaled the quarter length compared to the size. And so we did a bunch of takes like this. Okay. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to rescale these. Not rescale them, but just take snapshots at a particular time, which is the time where you expect them to be at the same stage in the evolution. And you see over here the four different vortices colored differently. And what I want you to sort of take away from this picture is the way in which they look similar to each other. It's a very reproducible technique. It gives you something that's similar. And if you scale them according to what you expect from the acceleration that you had and the velocity that you got to, you see you have an object which collapses. There's a curve collapse, but it's a three-dimensional curve collapse. And so then you can ask questions like Paul was asking, what about the rotation rate? Do these solutions behave like they should? And what do they do?
Have you tried this with like a figure eight knot instead?
That's work in progress.
Oh, okay. So is there a key for this, or is there other knots that are known to?
All torus knots. Kita considered all torus knots.
So they have solutions that just rotate.
Yes.
I think what we one of the problems with a torus knot is the complement of the knot it's fiber, but the sacred surface isn't it doesn't connect to your wing in a parallel way. It twists around the wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that twisting is part of the same thing creates. It is sort of a topological sort of reason why you would expect it to be difficult to maintain these
there's an angle of attack problem as you go around.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that could be.
Right, but with a figure eight knot, that's not a problem anymore. The wing can be straight up without the separate surface would connect to it at a uniform angle.
So what we plan to do essentially at this point is look at all sorts of shapes and topologies. This is the first one which we made. I'll show you now.
That's a key point. I was sort of implicitly learning the same thing, because you plunge it in one way and you want something that doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fluid flow around it should be sort of the fibers.
The fiber integration.
So one of the questions which you can ask now, which was sort of debated and hard to answer before, is what happens next? Right? What happens to these solutions as they evolve and propagate? Do they propagate for a long time? Do they survive for a long time? Or do they do something which you can't do in the local induction, interact with themselves and deform? And in particular, a big problem in hydrodynamics is the question of what happens when vortices kind of hit each other and come close to each other and reconnect. So what I want to show you now is the only way I knew to answer the question, which was to make one and observe it. And you saw in that movie an approach to a deformation. And I'm going to show this again and again. I'm just going to walk you through it. What you're going to see is that there's a deformation upon propagation. It doesn't only rotate. And then you get these filaments approaching each other. You get three reconnections. And eventually, you get the vortex to break up. So I'll just play that whole sequence again. But now I'm going to zoom in this area over here, and we're going to watch the reconnection process. Okay. This is kind of a tricky problem to image. So I'm almost about to conclude, but let me just show you this whole evolution a couple of times. A vortex knot gets created. It initially does roughly, qualitatively, what you'd expect the local induction approximation to make it do. It then deforms and finds itself and reconnects.
So you say there's no numerical simulation, isn't it?
There's a numerical simulation that looks approximately like this on the approach, but as far as I can tell, they're very, very cautious and don't really feel confident to say anything about what happens through the reconnection and afterwards. With one exception, actually, which came out very recently, which was some numerics done for a nonlinear Schrodinger equation in a BEC. And there, the dynamics which you see are kind of roughly similar. And I think that's essentially because this is, in fact, a good model system for all sorts of hydrodynamics.
I have some simulations that look exactly like that for a
while. Okay. So it'd be interesting to have a look.
Well, in fluids, the problem is just to encode a model of reconnection, and that is an open.
You're not supposed to encode anything, right? You're supposed to solve
to run code. To run the code.
You mean you can't?
Yeah, solve but when you're approaching reconnection, then how you move forward?
You mean just the stability of the?
It's the integration of differential functions.
When you have this large scale and this very tight small scale, which have to coexist, because the reconnection happens on this very small scale.
So it's just difficult to get the scales right.
I think so. I mean, I'm not a simulator, but from talking to people, but it would be good to talk about it and get a better feeling.
Can I put on my helmet, my experimentalist helmet? This is strong. So you're using like water and air, right? As the bubbles.
Well, I'm using water, and there's a little bit of hydrogen just to show where the vorticity is.
But is it possible, since some of there's a buoyant disturbance to the evolution created by the presence of those little bubbles? So how about using something that's closer in density, but it scatters light differently and doesn't create the buoyant?
Well, the whole point is the buoyancy gives you a way of tracing the core. So you can do that with dye, but then it's harder to image it. But the main point is, the bubbles are really a small perturbation. It's not like the dolphin ring.
So the scale of perturbation is really small.
We can't tell. In other words, we've done lots with fewer bubbles, even fewer bubbles. We see no difference at all.
If you use bubbles that were air, but were some other fluid that was closer, it still would end up at the core, but wouldn't create as much.
So we've done that too.
Yeah.
And they don't end up at the core.
Help it.
You used argon as the gas?
No. We could try distilled water, we could try. No, it doesn't really make a difference. So, the last thing I want to show you is that sort of kind of. I think of this a little bit like a technique to pattern vorticity in 3D. We sort of, through this combination of 3D printer and a little bit of design, have a way of patterning vorticity fields. And so I want to show you, we can do just not one shape, but I just want to show you one last shape before I conclude. And that's the pair of linked rings. And here again, you see the topological structure of the link rings, and you're about to see a very similar evolution afterwards. What you'll see is these link rings kind of approach each other again in a similar way, and you get a reconnection over here, a reconnection over here.
Presumably, there's again a key dissolution that really just rotates around itself for that torus link ring.
Yes. No, in this case, there's no. Because links are not covered by Kida because it's local induction.
But all the torus links must fit into the same. Oh. So someone should do it, and it's got to be the same.
The point is that the approximation, from step one, you can, by inspection, you can realize you can't do that. Because local induction is about not caring about the influence of all other parts of the vortex. It's about caring only about local things.
Oh.
So you don't care about the other vortex.
Oh.
And so it'll predict that they go just straight through each other. So to conclude this part, but also the talk, we've sort of what I've shown you, sort of excited to be able to show you at this meeting, is what, to the best of our knowledge, is the first vortex knot ever created. And to do it, we sort of had to figure out a way of patterning vorticity in 3D. and imaging it. And that's what a knot does. So I'll conclude just by thanking some of the people involved. Fridesh over here, who's working on the electromagnetic solutions. Martin, who's just starting on the fluid experiments. And of course, Dustin, who'll actually be here next week. So you'll be able to talk to him, who is involved in the fluid experiments. Thank you.
Thank you very much.